You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're discussing one of the critical themes up for discussion in the past week at the World Economic Forum in Davos, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and its global impact on everything from finance and economics to geopolitics and society. Published at the forum this week by UBS was a white paper entitled Extreme Automation and Connectivity: The Global, Regional and Investment Implications of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. We're going to hear from the report's authors and analysts, and from other experts around the world, about the likely impact of tensions stemming from these extraordinary changes. We start with Paul Donovan, UBS Deputy Head of Global Economics. Why all the talk about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, in Paul's view?
So what we're seeing with the Fourth Industrial Revolution is really a structural change, and that's what industrial revolutions are all about. To some extent, it's not even the technology that's the interesting thing. It's that the changes that take place change the way we work, change the way society is structured, change how we communicate with one another, change how we interact with other countries. It is a really profound alteration of the very structure of economics. And that's really where a lot of the risks and the challenges, but also the opportunities, are thrown up.
Bob Swarup is a commentator, author of Money Mania, and fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs. What does Bob make of the notion of a fourth industrial revolution in historical terms?
Well, I'll probably just interpret it in two ways. One is, I think politicians love buzzwords, and it's a great one to hang your hat on. It's very positive in a rather negative world right now. Is it an industrial revolution? I think, well, yes. I think if you look at a lot of the technologies that are out there, they are very, very radical, and they're shifting, by the way, not so much, let's say, in terms of building a new industry or things like that. While they are doing that, they're actually shifting the way people interact and work. And to me, that is the hallmark of an industrial revolution. That's what happened, by the way, if you look back at the first one. That's what happened when you go and think back about looking back in the 1920s when automation came in, mechanization came in. You know, it actually shifts how people interact. Society changes. And while the problems with that, by the way, and this is why I find it quite interesting what people are talking about, so I think they're desperately trying to find a positive message, is that there's also another cognitive dissonance here, which is technology moving the economy forward and moving us forward in bounds and leaps is fantastic. However, let's not forget, if you go back historically and look at the change is always disruptive. I mean, this is creative destruction in all its glory. Now, unfortunately, the problem is that if that happens in a world which is growing, nobody cares. But when you're in a world right now which is fragile, where people are worried about employment, people are very worried about the stability of growth, and importantly, there is a general sense of malaise in the economy and amongst people psychologically. On the other hand, they're also embracing the idea that the labor markets must be protected and cocooned in some form. The two cannot coexist, unfortunately.
Mark Haefeli, Global Chief Investment Officer for UBS Wealth Management, gives his take on the concept.
We tried to imagine this world with the Fourth Industrial Revolution and what would be kind of the big investment opportunities around this. So the Fourth Industrial Revolution is about smart devices in the cloud. Think robots talking to each other. And, you know, so that's in, and what's out is kind of cheap labor and resource extraction. And that has big impacts on certainly the economies and countries that are winners and losers.
And the overview from another of the analysts featured in the UBS report, Simon Smiles, Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth.
The Fourth Industrial Revolution is characterized by extreme automation and connectivity. It's similar in that regard, in featuring those two features. It's similar to the prior three industrial revolutions. But because of the extreme nature of these changes, it has a range of profound global economic consequences, regional economic and competitive consequences, and also investment consequences.
Next up, we asked our contributors to summarise the key challenges posed by the Fourth Industrial Revolution and its surrounding dynamics. Are they sector-specific? How will it be felt most profoundly, and where? Paul Donovan, again.
Well, I mean, the changes are really very, very profound. So if we think about international trade, for example, international trade could move more towards virtual trade. We trade ideas and we produce locally, rather than what we do at the moment, which is where you ship physical product around the world. Now, that has huge implications for transport, for the environment, for efficiency, for legal structures. I mean, you know, enormous implications which cascade from this one single fact. Greater communication changes not only how we receive information and how we perceive the world, but can also potentially change security risks, physical security risks. It can change cybersecurity risks. And that, again, you know, changes how we work, how we interact with one another.
We asked Paul Donovan whether automation and the like necessarily benefit, as one might imagine, principally developed markets.
Effectively, yes, this is something which is skewed towards benefiting the emerging markets. We've identified a framework for analysing how countries are likely to benefit, looking at four key areas. So the first is whether or not you can do capital for labour substitution, because that's what all this technological advance is likely to lead to. And providing you've got the flexibility to be able to do that, then this is going to disadvantage those countries which are focused on low-cost labour as being their competitive advantage. Secondly, skills. The return to skills is going to be very, very significant. But here it's important. It's not just the level of skills. It's the flexibility of how you learn. If you learn in a sort of rote learning type way, sort of a Dickensian grad grind school system, then fine, you may be the best qualified engineer in the world today, but your skills will be obsolete in 10 years' time. So you need to be able to learn not just skills, but how to change skills. And that, again, tends to favor the education systems of more developed economies. The third factor, I think, is infrastructure. You need to have an infrastructure which can adapt, an infrastructure which can change, because if you've got a lot of sunk costs in infrastructure and that infrastructure is no longer relevant, you know, if you've got huge ports capable of dealing with large amounts of goods and we've all gone over to 3D printing, then you're going to be at a disadvantage. And finally, the legal system, that in a world where you are more virtual, you need to have a robust legal system to make sure that people who come up with ideas are rewarded for those ideas, but also that you are, you know, prepared to trade those ideas with other people. If you have got a country which doesn't have a robust legal system, then people may not be willing to sell their ideas to you for fear that they will be copied and effectively stolen from you. So when you look at this framework of these four key areas where the fourth industrial revolution benefits, it is the case that developed economies, as things stand, tend to come out as being the better focused economies, and the weaker economies do tend to be in the emerging market complex.
And Simon Smiles too picks up on the regional dynamics of developed compared to developing markets.
There's a very clear divide between developed countries and developing countries, with developed markets seeming to be best placed to benefit from the fourth industrial revolution, unfortunately at the expense of many emerging markets who lack the flexibility of labour markets and the education systems and infrastructure to fully benefit from these changes.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look at labour markets, consider the critical import of economic flexibility, and ponder the value of forums like Davos in setting the global agenda. We look next at the impact on labour markets. Where will the force of the broader shifts we've been hearing about be felt most profoundly? Does Mark Haefeli, for instance, understand why labour changes are a focus for many governments in particular, and consequently why some people fear an increase in protectionism?
I really do see that. I mean, robots don't pay taxes. They don't pay income taxes. And so you think about how this immediately gets political, right? I mean, if you have many political economic systems are set up around income taxes, and so that's one aspect of it. The second aspect is that we're really talking about a world where the quality of your demographic is what's important, not the quantity of your demographic. And so the quantity of labor that you have can actually start to work against you in this world.
Do impending pressures on the labor market risk a further polarization of the labor force and also an increase in income inequality? Bob Swarup is in little doubt about the gravity of the situation.
It's inevitable. I mean, a lot of jobs will get wiped. I'll give you the best example that everyone's talking about, which I think they haven't perhaps connected the dots yet. There's a lot of talk about automated cars, the driverless car, right? You've heard Tesla talking about what they're doing. Google's allegedly trying to do, you know, test runs across America. Everyone's thinking about it. Now, in America, one of the single biggest industries and employers is the truck industry, who sit there and drive trucks across the vast, you know, plains of America constantly all through the day and night, etc., 365 days a year. If you have driverless cars, I would imagine the first buyers of that technology are going to be the truck companies, because the cost of labor is always usually, in almost any company, the biggest cost they have. This is why if you go into car manufacturers who've had a rather poor environment for them for the last few decades, most of them switched to having very automated factories, because by taking out the labor force, it made their profit margins that much more stable and allowed them to cope with the increasing costs of things like healthcare, pensions, and so on. So you see, the truck industry, I would say, embraces this. Unfortunately, you think about all the people they employ as drivers, they all get wiped out. So the job losses are inevitable. Now, if you go back and look at other industrial revolutions, let's not forget the very first one gave us the Luddites, if you remember, you know, Ned Ludd and his people who were busy there destroying mills and all the rest of it. And the reason is because, you know, the problem is when you destroy a livelihood and you destroy people's jobs, it takes time to adjust. You know, imagine just psychologically, if you lose a job tomorrow, well, guess what? You have to go out and look for another job. If your industry is cratering, you have to retrain. You have to think about, you know, what else could you do with your life? That takes years to adjust. I mean, you know, when the horse and carriage, for example, got wiped out, when domestic servants in the 19th century got wiped out by creeping automation, mechanization, when factories came in and suddenly we had refrigerators and washing machines, you know, a lot of industries went out of business alongside all of this. So you have an issue where as people come into the workforce, yes, new technology will give them new jobs, but those new jobs, by the way, take time to grow. People need to be trained for them. So if you don't plan for this shift, what you end up with is a lot of tension.
The notion of a fourth industrial revolution was one of the hot topics at Davos in the past week. And as we've heard, this issue throws up some critically important questions for the future. So just how important are forums like Davos at setting the agenda and helping to deliver workable solutions? Here's Simon Smiles again.
It's incredibly appropriate that a forum such as the World Economic Forum focuses on the fourth industrial revolution as the topic for this year's event. When you look at the plethora of countries potentially at risk of losing the demographic dividends from the developments associated with extreme automation and connectivity, countries like Argentina, Peru, Brazil, Mexico, India, all at relative risk, when you think about the potential implications for income inequality and wealth inequality even in developed countries, when one considers the potential impacts, both positive and negative, on different sectors, a potential further disruption to traditional industries from the extreme automation and connectivity, with the auto sector globally, or retail, or banks, travel, leisure and insurance, all potentially negatively impacted by new entrants into those sectors. And conversely, the range of potential beneficiaries and profound beneficiaries of big data, from utilities and energy efficiency to healthcare, and amazing developments and breakthroughs with respect to curing previously uncurable diseases and the like. The profound nature of these changes, the global nature of these effects, by necessity you need a gathering of global leadership and thought leaders to be able to grapple with something of this magnitude.
Given the focus at Davos then, what prospects are there for these broad tensions, a clash between technology and toil, if you like, to be addressed adequately? We asked Bob Swarup what he thinks.
I can tell you the stupid response, which is you start doing protectionist aspects. So, for example, you bring in things like age discrimination laws in a big way. You start having industries that suddenly get, you know, protected status of some sort. You start legislating against, you know, various industries in some form. The smart way of doing it is to actually move forward. You know, technology is vital to growth. You know, it just makes life more efficient. If you look at it this way, I mean, if you lived maybe 150 years ago, probably you'd have had 95% of your life was work, 5% was leisure. One of the really nice things about the industrial revolutions we've had so far is that actually, you know, we get a lot more leisure time and a lot less work. And if you look at the industries that now exist, a lot of these industries are, one might argue, derivative industries that don't really do work. They actually provide more leisure stuff for us. You know, look at the video games industry, look at the arts industry, cinema. I mean, there's so many things. And, you know, if you look at cultures and civilizations that have flourished, it's because they had so much money, they were able to almost invest into things like art and literature and leave some kind of legacy. And we like that. We all love that. And I think, you know, if in a sense, that's why you want to embrace technology, because it allows you to do more with your time.
Given the complexity of the challenges ahead, then, it's clear once more that economic flexibility is critical for countries and corporations alike to succeed in the future. As Paul Donovan explains, that's why it's one key element of the white paper.
I think economic flexibility is absolutely the most important issue. If you try and put up the barriers, if you try and defend dying sectors of the economy, as arguably, for example, the British did during the Third Industrial Revolution in the 1990s, when they were defending a way of life which was obsolete, then you impose costs across the economy and you risk lagging behind significantly. So economies need the flexibility to adapt. Individuals need the flexibility to adapt. People need to be able to evolve, to change their skills levels as the world around them changes. Revolutions are all about dramatic change, almost by definition. It can be a painful process to go through. I wouldn't for a moment deny that. But trying to preserve ourselves in some kind of historic ideal doesn't work.
On the programme, as well as asking the big questions, we also like to ensure we consider the immediate investment consequences of a whole range of scenarios. At Davos, we've had plenty of talk about the geopolitical and theoretical economic implications. But what about those investment consequences? We asked Mark Haefeli for his view.
We tried to look across the categories of the Fourth Industrial Revolution: labor structure, skill levels, education, suitability of infrastructure, and also very important legal protections, and just rank countries. And for us, using these categories, Switzerland comes out on top, Singapore, Netherlands, and Finland in the United States, United Kingdom, Hong Kong. So maybe sort of things that you would expect, but the key there is these are developed markets that already have a lot of things going for them. And then, you know, towards the bottom are countries that have a lot of their economy based on resource extraction or have very inflexible labor structures and legal protections that are really going to hurt them because, as you know, the speed of technological change, you've got to be flexible and you have to have a flexible workforce. So those, broadly speaking, for us, kind of things like United States and Europe will continue to benefit from this, and emerging markets, which are under pressure in the markets today, are likely to remain under pressure from some of these longer-term threats.
And that's Mark Haefeli, bringing us to the end of this 68th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.